respect constitutional restraints. They have to exercise what's called judicial self-restraint, because there aren't very many external checks on the judiciary on a day-to-day basis. So the judiciary has to restrain itself and be and engage in a constant process of asking itself, is this something that we are supposed to be doing, or are we stepping over the line and invading the area that is left to the legislative branch, for example? The judiciary has to engage in that on a constant basis.
Well, just suppose that Congress had not even acted in a certain area, and there's people that are bringing cases before the court that would give an opportunity to fill in on something that Congress didn't do. What about it?
The judiciary is not a lawmaking body. Congress is the lawmaking body. Congress has the legislative power. And the judiciary has to perform its own role and not try to perform the role of Congress or the executive.
I don't know whether you've ever had a case where the framers, where you're dealing with problems that the framers maybe in broad ways in the Constitution couldn't provide it for, but how would you apply the words of the Constitution then to problems that the framers could not have foreseen?
Well, there are very important provisions of the Constitution that are not cast in specific terms, and I think for a good reason. They set out a principle, and then it is up to the judiciary to apply that principle to the facts that arise during different periods in the history of our country. And the example that I like to cite here is the prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures in the Fourth Amendment. Now, this goes all the way back to the adoption of the Fourth Amendment at the end of the 18th century. And most of the types of searches that come up today are things that the framers never could have anticipated. They couldn't foresee automobiles or telephones or cell phones or the internet or any of the other means of communication that have presented new search and seizure issues, but they set out a good principle, and the principle is that searches can't be carried out unless they're reasonable, and generally there has to be a warrant issued by a neutral and detached magistrate before a search can be carried out. And so as these new types of searches have arisen, new means of communication have come into practice, the judiciary has applied this principle, and the legislative branch has applied the principle in statutes like the wiretapping statute to the new situations that have come up.
What factors, if any, and there may not be any, but what factors, if any, are there which can affect a judge's interpretation of the text of the Constitution? Can these factors be determined and applied without involving personal bias of judges?
I think they can. There would be no, I think, basis for judges to exercise the power of judicial review if they were doing nothing different from what the legislature does in passing statutes. So judges have to look to objective things. And if it's a question of absolutely first impression and there aren't that many constitutional issues that arise that at this point in our history that are completely issues of first impression, you would look to the text of the Constitution, and you would look to anything that would shed light on the way in which the provision would have been understood by people reading it at the time. You certainly would look to precedent, which is an objective factor, and most of the issues that come up in constitutional law now fall within an area in which there is a rich and often very complex body of doctrine that's worked out. Search and seizure is an example. Most of the issues that arise concerning freedom of speech is another example. There's a whole body of doctrine dealing with that, and that's objective, and you would look to that, and you would reason by analogy from the precedents that are in existence.
Let me bring up the tension between majority rule and individual freedoms. Involves the tensions between the American ideal of democratic rule and the concept of individual liberties, where neither the majority nor the minority can be fully trusted to define the proper spheres of our democratic authority and liberty. I assume that you agree that there is tension that has to be resolved.
There is tension because our system of government is fundamentally a democratic system. As I said, the authority to make the basic policy decisions that affect people's lives, most of them, most of those decisions are to be made by the legislature and by the executive in carrying out the law. But the judiciary has the responsibility to exercise the power of judicial review. And so if something comes up that violates the Constitution, then it's been established now going all the way back to Marbury versus Madison. If that comes up in the case, or it is the duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and to enforce the law in that decision. And if that means saying that something that another branch of government has done is unconstitutional, then that's what the judiciary has to do.
How would you go about your duties as a justice in determining where the right of the silent majority ends and where the right of the individual begins? What principles of constitutional interpretation help you to begin your analysis of whether a particular statute infringes upon some individual right?
I would look to the text of the provision. I would look to anything that sheds light on what that would have been understood to mean. I would look to precedent. And as I mentioned a minute ago, I think that in most of the areas now where constitutional issues come up with some frequency, there is a body of precedent. And that would be that shapes the decision. That's generally what is going to dictate the outcome in the case. And if it's a new question, then usually the judiciary will see where it fits into the body of precedent and reason by analogy from prior precedents.
Some judges and scholars believe that in resolving this dilemma, the court's obligation to the intent of the Constitution are so generalized and remote that judges are free to create a constitution that they think best fits today's changing society. What do you think of such an approach?
Judges don't have the authority to change the Constitution. The whole theory of judicial review that we have, I think, is contrary to that notion. The Constitution is an enduring document, and the Constitution doesn't change. It does contain some important general principles that have to be applied to new factual situations that come up. But in doing that, the judiciary has to be very careful not to inject its own views into the matter. It has to apply the principles that are in the Constitution to the situations that come before the judiciary.
I think you heard in opening comments of some of the members of this committee that they view the courts as a place taking the lead in creating a more just society. Is that a role for the courts? And I don't know whether you want to call this judicial activism, but I would. Is it ever justified?
Well, I think that if the courts do the job that they are supposed to do, we will produce a more just society. I think if you take a position as a federal judge, you have to have faith that if you do your job, then you will be helping to create a more just society. The Constitution and the constitutional system that we have is designed to produce a just society. It gives different responsibilities to different people. You could think of a football team, or you could think of an orchestra, where everybody has a different part to play. And the whole system won't work if people start performing the role of someone else. Everyone in the system has to perform their role, and I think you have to have faith, and I think it's a well-grounded faith that if you do that, if the judiciary does what it is supposed to do, the whole system will work toward producing a more just society.
I want to go back and expand on a point I referred to as maybe Congress not acting sometime and what the court should do about that. This is a line of questioning that I also asked Chief Justice Roberts when he was before us. At that time I referred to the confirmation of Justice Souter. And Justice Souter responded to my questions regarding the interpretation of statutory law by speaking about the courts filling vacuums in law left by Congress. Do you believe that the Supreme Court should fill in vacuums in the law left by Congress, or is this a way for justices to take an activist role in that they get to decide how to fill in generalities and resolve contradictions in law? If you are confirmed to the Senate, do you believe that your job is to fill in vacuums?
Well, I don't know exactly what Justice Souter was referring to when he said that, but just speaking for myself, I think that it is our job to interpret and to enforce the statutes that Congress passes, and not to add to those statutes and not to take away from those statutes.
Further on judicial restraint, are there any situations where you believe it is appropriate for the Supreme Court justice to depart from the issue at hand and announce broad, sweeping constitutional doctrine? And if you do, could you please describe in detail what those circumstances might be?
I think that the judiciary should decide the case that is – I think judges should decide the case that is before them. I think it's hard enough to do that and get it right. And if judges begin to go further and announce and decide questions that aren't before them, or issue opinions or statements about questions that aren't before them, from my personal experience, what happens when you do that is that you magnify the chances of getting something wrong. When you have an actual concrete case or controversy before you, focus on that. It improves your ability to think through the issue, and it focuses your thinking on the issue, and it makes for a better decision. If you just focus on the matter that is at hand and what you have to decide and not speak more broadly. If you speak more broadly, I think there's a real chance of saying something that you don't mean to say, or suggesting something that you don't mean to say, and deciding questions before they've been fully presented to you, before you've heard all the arguments about this other question that isn't really central to the case that is before you.
You might sometime be faced with what people might call a bad law or some unpopular law, which nonetheless might be constitutional. Do you believe that, I guess the question should be, what do you believe would be the court's role in that instance? Is the court ever justified in correcting what might be a problem out there by presumably created by a law Congress passed?
Courts do not have the authority to repeal statutes or to amend statutes. And so once a court has determined what a statute means, then it's the obligation of the courts to enforce that statute. Now, sometimes when a case of statutory interpretation comes before a court and your first look at the statute seems to produce an absurd result, let's say, or a very unjust result, then I think the judiciary has the obligation to go back and say, well, is this really what the statute means? Because the legislature generally is not going to want to produce a result like that. So maybe our first look at this statute has produced an interpretation that that's an incorrect statute. So I think we have to do that. And occasionally, a statute will come along or an administrative regulation will come along, and the way it's applied in a particular case shows that there's a problem with the statute or the regulation that maybe Congress didn't anticipate or the administrative agency didn't anticipate. And in those instances, while I think it is the obligation of the judiciary to apply the statute that is before the judiciary, I think it's proper for us to say, this shows how this statute or this regulation plays out in the real world in this situation. And maybe you didn't think about that, and maybe that's something that you want to take into account if you're going to revise the statute or issue a new regulation. I think those are proper roles for us.
What is your position regarding results-oriented jurisprudence where the rationale is made secondary to the actual result reached? When, if ever, is results-oriented jurisprudence justified?
Results-oriented jurisprudence is never justified because it is not our job to try to produce particular results. We are not policymakers, and we shouldn't be implementing any sort of policy agenda or policy preferences that we have.
In the past few decades, certain interest groups and legal scholars and even some members of Congress have tried to convert the Supreme Court from a legal institution into political, social, and cultural ones. Because of this, the court has morphed in that direction, I believe, becoming a battlefield for warring interest groups who are raising and spending millions of dollars on disinformation campaigns and website blogs. There's even blogs going on all the time about this hearing. Do you think it's because the Supreme Court has injected itself into policy issues better left to the elected branches of government, or has the Supreme Court tried to act as kind of a roving commission attempting to solve perceived societal problems, or maybe it's none of the above? What do you think can be done to restore the sense of constitutional balance between the Supreme Court and the executive and legislative branches of government, and understanding all are co-equal?
Well, I think the branches are co-equal, and I think that the judiciary as a whole, including the Supreme Court, must always be mindful of the role that it is supposed to play in our system of government. It has an important role to play, but it's a limited role, and it has to do what it is supposed to do vigilantly, but it also has to be equally vigilant about not stepping over the bounds and invading the authority of Congress or invading the authority of the executive or other government officials whose actions may be challenged. That's the challenge for the judiciary.
Thank you, Judge Alito.
Thank you, Senator Grassley. Senator Biden.
Joseph Biden, Democrat of Delaware.
I understand, Judge, I'm the only one standing between you and lunch, so I'll try to make this painless. Judge, I'd like to say a few very brief things at the outset. I'm puzzled, and I suspect you may be puzzled by some of the questions. I don't think anybody thinks you are a man lacking in integrity. I don't think anybody thinks that you are a person who's not independent. I think that what people are wondering about and puzzled about is not whether you are lack independence, whether you independently conclude that the executive is the trumps the other two branches. They wonder when you it's back in 85 or 84 when you wrote, I do not question the attorney general should have this immunity, that's absolute immunity, but for tactical reasons, et cetera. So it's people are puzzled, and at least some are puzzled. And so I don't want you to read any of this as, at least from my perspective, as I've read it so far, that people think that this is a bad guy. I mean, what people are puzzled about with the recusal issue was, under oath, you said, I will recuse myself on anything relating to, and then a case comes up. So they're looking for an explanation. So it's not about whether you are profiting or whether you are, you know, all this malarkey about whether you broke judicial ethics. It's, you know, a simple kind of thing. You know, you under oath said, I promise if this ever comes up, I'll recuse myself. And then you gave an explanation. You just, you know, it slipped, you forgot, it had been years earlier, et cetera. So don't read it as, you know, this is one of these things where we know you are. The people I've spoken to on your court, and it's my circuit, have a very high regard for you. And I think you're a man of integrity. The question is sometimes some of the things you've said and done puzzle, at least puzzle me. And I'd like to, and one of the things, this is not part of the line of question I wanted to ask, but I did ask you when you were kind enough to come to my office about the concerned alumni of Princeton. Where were you aware of some of the other things they were saying that had nothing to do with ROTC? Because there was a great deal of controversy. I mean, I can remember this. My son was he ended up going to that other university, the University of Pennsylvania. But I remember, you know, Princeton, I had spoken on campus in the early 70s. This was a big thing up at Princeton, at the Woodrow Wilson School. And I remember, I didn't remember Bill Frist, but I remember that there was this disavowing that Bill Bradley, this great basketball star and now United States Senator, was disassociating himself with this outfit, that there was a magazine called Prospect. I remember the magazine. And all I want to ask is, were you aware of the other things that this outfit was talking about? Were you aware of this controversy going on in 1972?
Senator, I don't believe that I was. And when It was mentioned that Senator Bradley had withdrawn from the magazine. That didn't ring any bells for me. I did not recall anything like that.
Well, it was a pretty outrageous group. I mean, I believe you that you were unaware of it, but here I was, University of Delaware graduate, a sitting United States senator. I was aware of it because I was up there on the campus. I mean, it was a big deal. It was a big deal, at least in our area, the Delaware Valley, if, you know, Princeton, Penn, the schools around there had this kind, because the big thing was going on at Brown at the time as well. And by the way, for the record, I know you know, when you stated in your application that you are a member, you said in 85, I am a member, they had restored ROTC. I mean, ROTC was back in the campus. But again, this is just by way of you know, why some of us are puzzled. Because if I was aware of it, and I didn't even like Princeton. I really didn't like Princeton. I was an Irish Catholic kid who thought it hadn't changed like you concluded it had. I mean, you know, I admit, I have a little, you know, one of my real dilemmas is I have two kids who went to Ivy League schools. I'm not sure my grandfather Finnegan will ever forgive me for allowing that to happen. But all kidding aside, I wasn't a big Princeton fan. And so maybe that's why I focused on it and no one else did. But I remember it at the time. The other thing is, Judge, you know, the other thing you should be aware of is, and kind of don't take this personally, what's going on here. Every nominee who comes before us is viewed by all the senators, left, right, center, Democrat, Republican, at least on two levels, at least in my experience here. One is, the first one is individual qualifications and what their constitutional methodology, their views are, their philosophy. But the other is, and it always occurs, whose spot they're taking and what impact that would have on the court. Everybody wrote with Roberts after the fact, and a lot of people voted for Roberts that were doubtful. I was doubtful. I voted no. But it was, he was replacing Rehnquist. So Roberts for Rehnquist, you know, what's the worst that can happen, quote unquote, or the best that can happen? No, I'm not being facetious. What's the best or worst? If you're conservative, the best that can happen is he's as good as Rehnquist. From the standpoint of someone who's a liberal, the worst that can happen, he's as good as Rehnquist. But you're replacing. I mean, this, we can't lose this. And so people understand this. You are replacing someone who has been the fulcrum on an otherwise evenly divided court. And a woman who's, most scholars who write about her and in a retrospective about her say, this is a woman who viewed things from, the phrase you've used, a real world perspective. This was a former legislator. This was a former practitioner. This was someone who came to the bench and applied to her critics. She applied too much common sense. Critics would say that she was too sensitive to the impact on individuals, you know, that what would happen in individuals. So her focus on the impact on individuals was sometimes criticized and praised. It's just important you understand, at least for my questioning, that this goes beyond you. It goes to whether or not your taking her seat will alter the constitutional framework of this country by shifting the balance 5-4, 4-5, one way or another. And that's the context in which at least I want to ask you my questions after trying to get some clarification or getting some clarification from you on concern Princeton. Because, again, a lot of this just is puzzling, not able to be answered, just puzzling. Judge, you and I both know, and clearly one of the hallmarks, at least in my view, of Justice O'Connor's position was she fully understood the real world of discrimination. I mean, she felt it. Graduated number two in her class from Stanford, couldn't get a job, was offered a job by law firms. I grant it, she's a little older than you are, but couldn't get a job because she was a woman that offered a job as a secretary. And so she understood what I think everybody here from both ends of the spectrum here understand, that discrimination has become very sophisticated. It's become very, very sophisticated, very much more subtle than it was when I got here 34 years ago or 50 years ago. And And employees don't say anymore, you know, we don't like blacks in this company, or we don't want women here. They say things like, well, they wouldn't fit in, or, you know, they tend to be too emotional, or, you know, a little high-strung. I mean, there's all different ways in which now it's become so much more subtle. And that's why we all, Democrat and Republican, wrote Title VII. We wrote these laws to try to get at what we observe in the real world. What we observed in the real world is it's real subtle. And so it's harder to make a case of discrimination, even though there's no doubt that it still exists. And so I'd like to talk to you about a couple of anti-discrimination cases. One is the Bray case. In that case, a black woman said she was denied a promotion for a job that she was clearly qualified for. There was no doubt she was qualified. And she said, I was denied that job because I'm a black woman. And it was, as I said, indisputable she was qualified. It was indisputable that the corporation failed to follow their usual internal hiring procedures. And the corporation gave conflicting explanations as to why they reached the decision to hire another woman who they asserted was more qualified than Ms. Bray. Now, the district court judge said, you know, Ms. Bray hadn't even made a prima facie case here, or she made a prima facie, but she had made a sufficient showing to get to a jury. I'm finding for the corporation here. And Ms. Bray's attorney appealed and went up to the Third Circuit. You and your colleagues disagreed. Two of your colleagues said, you know, Ms. Bray should have a jury trial here. And you said, no, I don't think she should. And you set out a standard, as best I can understand it. I want to talk to you about it. And your colleagues said that if they applied your standard in Title VII cases, that discrimination cases, that it would effectively, their words, eviscerate Title VII, because they went on to say it ignores the realities of racial animus. They went on to say that racial animus runs so deep in some people that they're incapable of acknowledging that a black woman is qualified for a job. But Judge, you dismissed that assertion. You said that the conflicting statements that the employer made were just loose language, and you expressed your concern about allowing disgruntled employees to impose cost of a trial on employers. And so your colleagues thought you set the bar, I think it's fair to say, pretty high in order to make the case that it should go to a jury. Can you tell me what the difference is between a business judgment as to who's most qualified? Because that you said this comes down to subjective business judgment and discrimination. You said subjective business judgment should prevail unless the qualifications of the candidate are extremely disproportionate. What's the difference between that in today's world and discrimination? And I know you want to eliminate discrimination. Explain to me how that test is distinguishable from just plain old discrimination.
Well, this case was one of quite a few that we get that are on the line. And we have to, and I think when you think about the nature of the appellate system, it stands to reason that it's going to work out that way. The really strong cases tend to settle. The really weak cases are either dismissed and not appealed, or they settle for a modest amount. So the ones that are hotly contested on appeal tend to be the ones that are close to the line, whatever the legal standard is. Now, four federal judges looked at the facts in this case. One was Judge Marianne Trump Barry, who was then the district court judge and is now one of my colleagues on the Third Circuit. I was one. And we thought the evidence was not quite sufficient. And then my colleague Theodore McKee and Judge Green, District Court Judge from Philadelphia, fine District Court Judge sitting by designation, thought that the evidence was sufficient. And I think that division illustrates this was a factual case on which reasonable people would disagree. This was a case in which there was no direct evidence of discrimination. And I could not agree with you more that we can't stop there. There are subtle forms of discrimination, and the judicial process has to be attentive to the fact that discrimination exists, and today a lot of it's driven underground. But all there was in this case were all that the plaintiff could point to show that there were facts from which you could infer discrimination were what looked like a really minor violation of the company's internal practices. They had a policy under which if somebody was being considered for a promotion, they would interview that person and they would decide we're going to promote or we're not going to promote. And if they decided we're not going to promote, then they were supposed to tell that person we've decided we're not going to promote you before they go on to interviewing the next person. And in this instance, it appeared that they interviewed Ms. Bray, and they decided they weren't going to promote her, and then they interviewed the other candidate, Ms. Real, before they told Ms. Bray that they weren't going to promote her. They had nothing to gain by doing that. So it's a fact to be considered.
Judge, I don't want to interrupt. I'm not sure I understand. I think the reason for that policy is that's the way people do discriminate. For example, you get somebody in, a woman, a black, Hispanic, whomever, who's qualified, but you don't want to hire them. And if you say, okay, I'm going to keep looking till I find somebody who's more qualified so that I don't have to hire. Just so we both understand, that's why that rule's there. It is not just a little deal. It's the real world. That's how people work. People don't say anymore, I'm not going to hire that man over there because he is black or he is Jewish or he is or she is a woman. They don't do that anymore. What they do is they look around and they keep looking till they find someone. Aha, I got one here who's a Rhodes Scholar. I got one here who's a white male who happened to have experience doing it. That's why they had that rule. So, again, I'm not questioning your commitment to civil rights. What I do wonder about is whether or not you presumptuous of me to say this, whether you fully appreciate how discrimination does work today. That's why the corporation set that rule up. Interview the one inside the company. That was our practice to hire inside. Tell them they have the job or not, so that the supervisor who may not want to work with a black woman doesn't get a chance to go, I'm going to keep looking. Send me and find me somebody who has some experience somewhere else. That's why they'd have the rule, right?
Well, I think you make a good point, Senator. But in this instance, my recollection is, and I'm quite sure of this, these were both people who were from the inside. They were both Marriott employees. And I think they were both being considered for the position at the time. So it wasn't an instance in which they interviewed Ms. Bray and then they said, well, she's qualified, but we really don't want to hire her. Let's keep looking. If there had been evidence to that effect, then I would certainly think, for the reasons that you've outlined, that you could draw a pretty substantial inference of an intent to discriminate from that. But that was presented to us in that case, as I remember it.
Weren't the facts in that case also that there's a Mr. Jostin who had held the very job? He was leaving the job. That's the job being filled. He said, in my opinion, which I let be known, excuse me, beg your pardon, it wasn't Mr. Jostin, the person who was giving up the job, said, in my opinion, I let it be known to Mr. Jostin, the guy doing the hiring, and which Mr. Jostin was aware of, that Brill was more than qualified to take over my positions as director of services of Park Ridge. To this day, this quote, I cannot understand why she was not offered the position. That was in the record. It was in the record that that Jostin had said in a deposition under oath, she's not qualified, when she clearly was qualified. I mean, I guess what I'm curious about is, why in a close case like this wouldn't you let the jury decide it? Why did you become essentially the trier of fact? I mean, what was your thinking?
Well, my thinking was that the standard we were to apply was, could a reasonable jury find that discrimination was proven here? And it was my view, and it was the view of the district judge, that a reasonable jury couldn't find that. When the district judge actually looked at the qualifications of the two candidates and said, this isn't even close. Ms. Real is much better qualified than Ms. Bray. Now, I didn't I didn't say that, and I didn't think that. I thought that they had somewhat different qualifications, and a reasonable person could view it either way, but there just wasn't anything that I saw that a reasonable person could point to as a basis for a reasonable inference of an intent to discriminate.
Well, again, I'm puzzled by this, just trying to understand your reasoning, because as you accurately point out, you didn't say the one was more qualified. You said they were equally qualified, and that's what puzzled me. And what really got my attention in the case was, you have a pretty collegial court, the Third Circuit. I mean, that's my observation. I don't follow quite as closely as the man who's appointed about everybody on that court, our chairman, but I follow it very closely. And I thought it was pretty strong language that your majority of your panel said that your standard would eviscerate the Ninth Amendment. That, in Third Circuit language, is pretty strong statement. But let me move on to another case, if I may. The Sheridan case, another discrimination case. Again, a little puzzling to me. Yet, this is a case where you were the only judge in this circumstance out of 11 judges on your circuit who heard the appeal who ruled that a jury trial should have been overruled, a jury verdict should have been overruled. In this case, a woman alleged that she was constructively discharged. For the non-lawyers listening to this, it means she basically was demoted to the point where she was, as a practical matter, forced to quit. That this woman alleged that she was constructively discharged, and she argued that it occurred after she had brought a discrimination claim, and where the record showed that her employer said, "I'm going to hound you like a dog." It was in the record. "I'm going to hound you like a dog for bringing this discrimination claim." Now, and there were more than one issue. One was whether this was vindictive, I forget the proper phrase, or whether or not she should have been promoted. The third was whether she was constructively discharged. And the jury heard the case and said, "We conclude she was constructively discharged, i.e., she was basically forced out. And she was forced out because she was being discriminated against." And 10 out of 11 of your colleagues reached that same conclusion. But you said, and this is what I want you to explain to me, you said, "An employer may not wish to disclose his real reasons for taking punitive action against someone, or not hiring someone, or for his animosity towards someone." And you went on to say, "The reason for the animosity on the part of the employer might be based on sheer personal antipathy, which is okay." Now, again, this is a matter of real world versus, theoretically. Can you tell me how you can tell the difference when an employer is saying, "Ms. Feinstein, I am not going to hire you because the person seeking the job has a Rhodes Scholarship and I like them better, and it turns out they weren't a Rhodes Scholar. The real reason is I just don't like your glasses. I don't like the way you look." I'm not being facetious. That's
I do. Thank you.
By the way.
I like the way you look, Diane. Look okay.
For the record, I'm a fan of the woman from California.
Yeah.
But all kidding aside, I mean, that's how it read to me, that sheer personal antipathy is okay, even when the employer's reason for not hiring the person toward whom they showed sheer personal antipathy weren't true. How's that? How do you distinguish that from discrimination? Subtle discrimination. That's tough for me.
Well, this case concerned an issue that had really divided the courts of appeals at the time when our court addressed it, and the courts of appeals had this gets into a fairly technical question involving a Supreme Court case called the McDonnell-Douglas case. But to put it in simple terms, the courts of appeals had divided into three camps on this. There was the pretext plus camp, which was the one that was the least hospitable to claims by employees. There was the pretext only camp, which was the camp that was most favorable to employees. And there was the middle camp. And my position was in the middle camp. And when the issue went to the Supreme Court, and it did a couple of years later, in Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing, Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion for the Supreme Court, and she agreed with my analysis of this legal issue, that in most instances, pretext is sufficient. In fact, in the vast majority of instances, if the plaintiff can show or create a point to enough evidence to show that the reason given by the employer is a pretext, is incorrect, then that's enough to go to the jury. In the vast majority of cases, that's sufficient, but not in every case. And that's what I said in Sheridan, and that's what Justice O'Connor said when she wrote the opinion for the Supreme Court in the Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing.
Well, I went back and read Reeves, and I looked at O'Connor's statements, and with all due respect, you could argue she used the same standard, but it's clear to me she would have reached a different conclusion. She would have been with your 10 colleagues. Here's what she said. She said in the Reeves case that she would not send a case to the jury if, and I'm quoting, one, the record conclusively reveals some other non-discriminatory reason for the employer's decision. I fail to see how the record conclusively showed that, and I doubt whether she would have seen that. Or two, continuing to quote, if the plaintiff created only a weak issue of fact as to whether the employer's reason was untrue and there was abundant, uncontroverted evidence that no discrimination had occurred. It seems to me she's much more prepared to give the benefit of the doubt to the employee in that situation, and you're much more prepared to give the benefit of the doubt to the employer. I mean, by her own language, I find it hard to figure how she would have reached the same substantive conclusion that you did, that a jury trial wasn't appropriate. Notwithstanding the fact, I think you make a good point, that the test she set was more like the test you set. But the real-world outcome, I think she would have been, presumptuous of me to say it, I think it would have been 11-1 and not 10-2 had she been on the court, but who knows?
Well, Senator, I think the vote on my court was a reflection of the standard that they applied, and they did not apply the Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing standard. Of course, Reeves hadn't been decided at that point, but they applied the standard that said if the plaintiff can create a fact issue as to whether it was pretextual, then that alone is sufficient. So they didn't get into an evaluation of the sort of evidentiary points that
you were mentioning. You'd know better than I, Judge. I don't mean to suggest I'm correcting you, but if you're as I read the case, they did get into the minutia.
They did.
About the factual minutia. And in the Reeves case, O'Connor, not that it's because there were two different cases we're talking about here. We're talking about a similar rule, two different cases. O'Connor reversed the Fifth Circuit decision. And here's what she said when she reversed it. She said that the lower court reversed the lower court because, quote, it proceeded from the assumption that a prima facie case of discrimination combined with sufficient evidence for the trier of fact to disbelieve the defendant's legitimate non-discriminatory reason for its decision is insufficient as a matter of law to sustain a jury finding of intentional discrimination. It seems to me that's what you did, my view, that's what you did in, that's the conclusion you reached in the Sheridan case. She overruled in Reeves, as I read it, but at any rate, you, like as someone once said, it's your day job, and we do this part-time. We have other things like wars and foreign policy to deal with, so I'm not presuming to be as knowledgeable about this as you do. Let me move on to a third case very quickly. I only have 2.5 minutes left. And it's the Casey case, Planned Parenthood. And I don't care what your position is on abortion. This is not about your abortion. It's about your reasoning here. As a matter of fact, with 2 minutes and 30 seconds, I probably can't get into the case. Maybe I should do it in a second round. But I should tell you now, I want to talk to you about, again, the real world here and kind of the effects test. And so for me, Judge, where I am still remain somewhat puzzled is on whether or not you, whether it's applying the unitary executive standard and what you mean by that, or whether it is the assertions made relative to how to look at discrimination cases, which are difficult, you seem to come down. I'm not associating myself with the studies done. I don't know enough to know whether they're correct or not by Cass Sunstein and others. I don't disagree with them. But as I've tried diligently to look at your record, you seem to come down more often and give the benefit of the doubt to the outfit against whom discrimination is being alleged. You seem to lean, in close cases, you lean to the state versus the individual. Now, again, a lot of constitutional scholars would argue that's perfectly correct. All I'm suggesting is, if I'm right, and we'll get a chance to do this again, if I'm right, that would be a change that will occur more than subtle on the bench, on this court, on a closely divided court, which would take it in a direction that I am not as comfortable with as others may be. But at any rate, you've been very gracious. I appreciate you being responsive, and I thank the chair. And I want to note, for maybe the first time in history, Biden's 40 seconds under his time.
Thank you very much, Senator Biden. Greatly appreciated. We're going to stay in session for just 10 more minutes, and a call now on Senator Kyle.
Thank you, Mr.
John
Chairman.
Kyle, Republican of Arizona.
Mr. Chairman, let me begin by just asking the witness if you'd like to comment again on the unitary executive. I have this specifically in mind because while I think I understood your explanation of it, Senator Biden just referred to it, and I thought maybe it would be useful to draw the distinction that I heard you draw with respect to your discussion of the unitary executive power, if you could do that, please.
Yes, certainly, Senator. As I understand the concept, it is the concept that the president is the head of the executive branch. The Constitution says that the president is given the executive power. And the idea of the unitary executive is that the president should be able to control the executive branch, however big it is or however small it is, whether it's as small as it was when George Washington was president, or whether it's as big as it is today, or even bigger. It has to do with control of whatever the executive is doing. It doesn't have to do with the scope of executive power. It does not have to do with whether the executive power that the president is given includes a lot of unnamed powers or what's often called inherent powers. So it's the issue, it's the difference between scope and control. And as I understand the idea of the unitary executive, it goes just to the question of control. It doesn't go to the question of scope.
Of who eventually has the last say about executive power, which would be the president.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Now, I want to also ask you a question which was asked of Judge Bork in his confirmation hearing, and his answer, as I understand it, was not well accepted by some members of the Senate, was expressed as a reason for their – one of the reasons for their opposition to him. So it's more than just a mundane question, although it's a simple question. By accepting the president's nomination, you've obviously expressed a willingness to serve on the United States Supreme Court. So my question is, why would you want to serve on the United States Supreme Court?
I think it's an opportunity for me to serve the country, using whatever talent I have. I think that the courts have a very important role to play, but it's a limited role. So it's important for them to do a good job of doing what they're supposed to do, but also not to try to do somebody else's job. And I think that this is an area for me, this is a way in which I can make a contribution to the country and to society. I've tried to do that on the Court of Appeals, and I would continue to do that if I'm confirmed for the Supreme Court.
Thank you. Now, let me ask you a question that I also asked now Chief Justice John Roberts. And it's obvious from my question that I do not support the use of foreign law as authority in United States court opinions. I mentioned to him the 2005 case of Roper versus Simmons, in which the Supreme Court spent perhaps 20% of its legal analysis discussing the laws of Great Britain, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Iran, Nigeria, and China. And I reminded the Committee of Justice Breyer's 1999 dissent from denial of cert in Knight versus Florida, in which he relied on the legal opinions of Zimbabwe, India, Jamaica, and Canada, in arguing that a delay caused by a convicted murderer's repeated appeals brought by the convict, should be considered cruel and unusual punishment. I expressed my view that reliance on foreign law is contrary to our constitutional traditions. It undermines democratic self-government, and it's utterly impractical given the diversity of legal viewpoints worldwide, and would add that it's needlessly disrespectful of the American people, as seen through the widespread public criticism of the trend. Now, with my cards on the table, I turn to you. What is the proper role, in your view, of foreign law in U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and when, if ever, is citation to or reliance on these foreign laws appropriate?
I don't think that foreign law is helpful in interpreting the Constitution. Our Constitution does two basic things. It sets out the structure of our government and it protects fundamental rights. The structure of our government is unique to our country, and so I don't think that looking to decisions of Supreme Courts of other countries or constitutional courts in other countries is very helpful in deciding questions relating to the structure of our government. As for the protection of individual rights, I think that we should look to our own Constitution and our own precedents. Our country has been the leader in protecting individual rights. If you look at what the world looked like at the time of the adoption of the Bill of Rights, there were not many that protected human. In fact, I don't think there were any that protected human rights the way our Bill of Rights did. We have our own law, we have our own traditions, we have our own precedents, and we should look to that in interpreting our Constitution. There are other legal issues that come up in which I think it's legitimate to look to foreign law. For example, if a question comes up concerning the interpretation of a treaty that's been entered into by many countries, I don't see anything wrong with seeing the way the treaty has been interpreted in other countries. I wouldn't say that that's controlling, but it's something that can be that is useful to look to. In private litigation, it's often the case. I've had cases like this in which the rule of decision is based on foreign law. There may be a contract between parties, and the parties will say this.